thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here. I really hope to visit, since I'm on the other side of Canada, but unfortunately that hasn't happened before the pandemic, and now it's like a little difficult, but at least I'm happy to join you virtually. Right, so I'm going to talk about black hole archaeology, something like something I coined a few weeks ago, and I'm pretty excited about the title. I was hoping it would allow me to put lots of Indiana Jones references throughout the talk, but unfortunately I ran out of time. So you have to imagine those a bit, and I'm going to explain what I mean in a second. Let me just start off saying that, as Neil was saying, I am super excited about gravitational waves. I think they are a completely new way of looking at our universe. And I think they will also be a good probe of particle physics. So gravitational waves are, kind of very different from other probes that we have used. And the unique opportunities are that you can use them to probe objects which are dark, or at least don't emit lights. And black holes are a good example of that. And you can also use them to look back in the past, since gravitational waves were never in thermal equilibrium. So the universe was never opaque to gravitational waves. So in principle, you could use gravitational radiation to look back very far in the past into the early universe. So I won't talk about that today, but that's also a kind of an interest area of mine. Now, of course, what is for a phenomenologist like myself interesting is that we actually have data, and the data set is growing pretty rapidly. So currently we already have 50 merger events detected by the LIGO Virgo collaboration and counting. So this is still gonna go up this year and then in the next few years, and we're gonna in the next decade or so cover different ranges in frequency with all the new experiments that are planned or under construction, including LISA, for example, including atom interferometry, including pulsar timing arrays. So all in all, I think this is a fantastic new probe and a very exciting way to learn about particle physics using gravitational waves. That's kind of my overall excitement. Now let's go to that data set that we already have. So this is kind of a nice representation of the binary mergers detected in the first half of the third observation run by the LIGO and Virgo collaboration. So this has also been referred to as the stellar graveyard, because these things, these black holes and neutron stars, are probably, we think, remnants of heavy stars. And so what you see here is just nothing. There's no kind of order to the x-axis, but on the y-axis you have the mass in solar masses, the inferred mass in solar masses from the gravitation waveform of these objects. So first the two components that were merging, and then the remnant mass. So what I want to do is a bit of like archaeology, and what I want to talk about is some order to this to these masses, to these spectra. So first, what you it's kind of obvious and something that you probably know about is that, there is kind of a gap between the heaviest neutron star that's been observed and the lightest black hole that's been observed. So this is something that, is referred to as a mass gap. And, the LIGO-Virgo collaboration themselves also, when they detect a component inside this gap, I think they define it from 2 to 5 solar masses. They even mark it. Mass gap. But something that is less well studied and something that's only now coming into focus a bit more is this other mass gap, which would exist at higher masses, so around about 50 solar masses upwards in the black hole mass spectrum. And that is what I'm going to talk about. So I just wanted to point out, this very special merger, very close to my heart, GW190521, which was announced and publicized last September. And I just, added this sort of article that was in the New York Times about it. This is a very surprising event. A little bit more on that later. But these black holes are, above where I've marked the mass gap already. So these are very heavy, and surprising that they even exist at all. Okay, So, you know, to study a bit of like order to this mass spectrum, we need to actually kind of think about, you know, what these things are, what populates the stellar graveyards. And so astrophysically, like these remnants, these black holes and these neutron stars in the LIGO and Virgo mass range, so these will be predominantly remnants of heavy, very heavy and low metallicity early stars. So when I say low metallicity, I mean the mass fraction of elements of a higher like number than hydrogen and helium is small. So these things are mostly formed, created like these composed of hydrogen and helium, and they're very heavy stars. So these, you know, would primarily have existed at higher redshifts than today. They could be the population three stars, hypothetical objects that have not been observed directly, but would have existed at high redshifts and potentially could be seen directly by JWST, depending on like lensing, etc. So these would have evolved, and these would have already evolved like at high redshifts and eventually collapsed into black holes in the Kurkulap supernova explosions. But there's a little asterisk to that, and that's what I'm going to talk about now. Because so to sort of study what happens to these, you can evolve a star, and we're going to start at the 0H helium branch, which is after hydrogen burning when the star starts burning helium. So this is a type of plane that I'm going to show a bit more often. So this is kind of a good way to keep track of what's happening in the star. On the y-axis, I'm showing the temperature of the core of the star in Kelvin, because I really, as a particle physicist, had to get used to astrophysical units. And here on the x-axis, I'm showing the core density of the star in grams per centimeter cubed. So I'm showing the evolution of three different stars. And you should imagine that I'm starting off here. I'm initializing the stars here on the 0H helium branch, which is just before these stars become hot enough in their core to start burning helium. And then they evolve towards the upper right of this plane. So this is three different stars. They're all very heavy, but some are heavier than others. The green one is the 40 solar mass lightest one, and the blue one is the 120 solar mass heaviest one. And you see that for the same density, the heavier stars are hotter. So we simulate their evolution. So what happens in this evolution that's important? So helium burning is what fuels the star in this first stage here. And there's two nuclear reactions that that give the star energy and keep its core from collapsing. And the first one is like this triple alpha process. It's called triple alpha because I have three alpha particles, three helium particles. First, you have these two helium fusing into beryllium and releasing energy. And then this beryllium can capture another helium particle and release energy again and form carbon. So this is an exothermic process. Then there's another one that's important, and that's where this carbon atom, you know, captures another alpha particle, another helium particle, and forms oxygen at the end of the day. So these are the main nuclear reactions going on during helium burning, which keep the star from collapsing. So the star evolves, gets hotter through this reaction, eventually runs out of alpha particles to burn, runs out of helium to burn. And then what happens is the core can't really stabilize itself against gravitational collapse anymore. So it starts to collapse, heats up again. And as it gets hotter, eventually it becomes hot enough to start burning carbon. And then there's a whole host of other nuclear reactions that are important. I just put them here kind of for completeness. This is not super important for what I'm going to talk about today. So what I haven't told you yet about this plane is actually what is very important. And that is that there is this region here, which some of these stars enter or kind of almost enter, which is an unstable region. And what happens here is very interesting. So these are very hot temperatures. I don't know if you have a good feel for the temperatures that stars typically have, but the sun I guess you if you would put this on that this same type of axis, it would actually be, you know, below the range of this plot at 10 to the 7 Kelvin, about the core of the sun. So these are very hot temperatures. And in fact, they're so hot that you can start to actually create electron-positron pairs from the plasma in the star. So you have enough thermal energy to form electron-positron pairs via just gamma-gamma going to E plus E minus. So you might say, huh, okay, if you do this calculation like kind of quickly, you convert the electron mass to Kelvin units, then you say, okay, that's a bit hotter actually still than the temperature I was talking about. But as you know, these things are, you know, have some sort of Boltzmann distribution. So in the tail of that distribution, you still form these things. Now, because the temperature is still higher than the mass of these things, when they're formed, they're typically non-relativistic. And so that's important because the stars in this range are supported by radiation pressure. They're supported by like outward pressure from the photons and radiation. And now I'm actually forming, like I'm taking these photons and I'm forming E plus and minus pairs that just sit there and are non-relativistic. And so what I'm doing is I'm softening the equation of state. And so in this region, the equation of state is softened by these electron positron pairs, and the star becomes unstable. So the shape of this region is also kind of, you know, easy to understand from what I just told you. Here at the top, like for these higher temperatures, the electron positron pairs, they become relativistic and therefore support the star. Here below, on the below in this region, this process is Boltzmann suppressed. And here towards the right, a few things are going on. The star is actually not supported anymore by like radiation pressure, but more by ion pressure. And of course, also there is like electron degeneracy somewhere in this region as well. So that gives you kind of like an idea of the what the shape of this region comes from. Now, what you want to know, of course, like what happens when, you know, the star enters this region in which electron positron pair creation renders it unstable against gravity. So what ends up happening, it has a lot to do with the nuclear reactions that took place during helium burning and the chemical composition of the star at the end of helium burning. And so because this the second process that I was talking about forms oxygen, oxygen has this explosive burning cycle, which takes over here in this unstable region. So just to sort of give you that information in a nutshell, I've adapted this plot from this very nice paper last year, which kind of shows you what's going on. So I'm starting off with a star at the zero helium branch. Then the first thing that's important that happens is that the core heats up so much that non-relativistic A plus A minus pairs are created in the plasma, which trigger collapse. That's what I just told you. Then explosive burning of oxygen, so which was a burning product of helium, gets ignited. And then one of three things might happen. So either for very heavy stars, there is this other instability, photodisintegration instability, which triggers immediate black hole collapse. So from here, you go immediately to black hole collapse, and that happens for very, very heavy stars. So I'm not really going to talk about this too much, but I just wanted to mention that that's possible. Then for somewhat lighter stars, either this explosive oxygen burning process is so violent that it completely unbinds, like gravitationally unbinds all of the material on the star and no remnants is left. So that's called a para-instability supernova. So that happens for like these kind of intermediate, very heavy initial star masses. Or this is like a violent process. Shoots out, like it ejects some of the material in the star, but not all of it. And some of it is still gravitationally bound. And then you cool again, and you can actually go through this whole process again, like this electron positron pair creation, collapse, explosion, etc. So you might even go through this cycle a few times, ejecting material at this step every time. This is called a pulsational pair instability supernova. Eventually, then you might cool down again and then collapse into a black hole. But this black hole is a whole lot lighter than you would have expected if it wasn't for this step. Okay,
Judah, can I ask something?
Yeah, absolutely.
So for the calculations, you know, that are behind what you're showing here, mm-hmm. you know, like, so are these all like in 1D, you know, calculations of stars that are like not rotating and have, you know, no mm-hmm. convection or anything?
Yeah, good. So these are calculations that with MESA, like, so, I mean, this is not a calculation, but yeah, this is. So we're simulating this with MESA. Indeed, that's a 1D stellar evolution code. So we are mostly caring about this step and not actually simulating the core collapse supernova process at the end, just taking what's gravitationally bound at the end. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so they're non-rotating. For us, like I'll get to this in a minute, but we care about like the highest possible mass that you can form in this way. And non-rotation, like rotation typically means that more mass is shed. So this is kind of like a bit more of a conservative thing. But yeah, definitely, like if you have a rotating object, that would change like this picture quantitatively somewhat.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, great. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's lots to be studied here. Just to give you an idea of what would happen. So this is kind of also, I guess, like, I'm not really caring about the numbers, it's this plot, just to show you what happens for a particular set of stars. Here, I'm taking like somewhat high metallicity, just like, you know, a factor 10, like the solar metallicity over 10. So that's quite high for what I'm showing, but just to give you some intuition, I'm showing you like the initial masses of, you know, stars. And then their final masses here in red. So this is again the mass of the black hole remnant that you would expect. So this green line here is the line y equals x. And so you see that first here on the left side of this plot, you know, the black holes that you form are not the same as the stars you went in with in mass. But there's this difference, and that difference is explained by stellar winds. So stellar winds is just a way in which like the outer layers, the more loosely bound layers of the star are shed. And so that's like a pretty good prediction for the final black hole mass here at the left of the plane, up until some point where you start to deviate from that line. So the final mass of the black hole becomes different than the mass that you have at helium depletion. And so it's not explained just by stellar winds. And you're shedding mass here. And what happens is that this positional pair instability supernova becomes important. And that becomes more and more violent, this process, and you're shedding more and more mass until here, like towards the right, eventually you end up with no remnant at all. And if I would have continued this plot further to the right, I would have not seen any remnants for like quite a long time until eventually this photodisintegration instability picks up some masses again, and these would be here somewhat like on this line again. So I mean, a direct consequence of this is that you see here that above here, this, if you draw the asymptote to this line here, there's no black hole remnants for this range of masses upwards, and that's what's called the black hole mass gap. Now, okay, so of course there is some dependence on like known physics, you know, in this kind of calculation. And so there was this interesting paper from late 2019. So this is actually long before I even knew about this pair instability, studying already, you know, all of the kind of different effects that change the prediction of the black hole mass gap. And this is kind of a nice summary plot from that paper where these people have varied different parameters to see what that does to the prediction of the heaviest black hole before the mass gap. And so you see here that like changing, you know, stuff about the numerics changes the black hole mass gap by a bit. Then physics dependence, there's some dependence on the weak parameters, but here the very most important thing are the metallicity, the stellar winds, which are kind of related things in their prescription, and the rates. And rates, what's meant by rates here is the nuclear rates, and in particular, the rate, the converting carbon into oxygen. So it's probably quite intuitive because oxygen is the kind of thing that does the explosive burning, which, you know, leads to the shedding of the mass. So the uncertainty in the rates converting carbon into oxygen is super important in like this prediction. Now, there is some better news. I should have changed this number somewhat because we find something somewhat different, but this was done with a old nuclear rates, which was like in the Starlib catalog. But that's actually, you know, people are working on this rate. This is kind of a big target in nuclear physics experiment and also ab initio calculations. And this collaboration with James de Boer has an updated rate. And if you use that, the same people found instead like a shifted value here, but with much smaller error bars. So plus zero, minus four is this kind of asymmetric error, which is dominated by the error found in the error bars of the nuclear physics experiments. So we find something like kind of compatible with this, like at the one sigma level or the less than one sigma level. So the important kind of point here is that the error bars shrink by quite a lot compared to what was shown here, which is 15 solar masses. So it's more, you know, also kind of order a couple to a few. Right. So what I'm interested in is like, what about beyond the standard model of physics? Because like, just to recap, you know, the existence of this black hole mass gap is pretty robust prediction just purely from standard model physics. And it's a direct consequence of a few things that we're fairly certain about, which are the temperature and the density of stars in the post-main sequence evolution, the mass of the electron, and the burning products of helium. So these are three things that are, you know, we're pretty certain about. So this is a pretty robust prediction, if not exactly numerically, you know, kind of, well, what value it is, we are certain of its existence. And, you know, this is a pretty, it depends pretty sensitively on what's going on in the core of the star. And so, you know, sometime around this time last year, I was wondering, what if like there's new physics beyond the standard model, which affects the processes in the star, what does that do to this prediction? And that's been pretty interesting. So, you know, I've been working with Sam McDermott and Jeremy Sexton and like occasionally joined by other collaborators to figure this out. And we're far from done. So what I'm going to tell you is just sort of the really first hints of like things that might happen, the simplest thing we could have done, but we're still kind of working on, you know, all figuring out all of the possible effects. So, you know, just sort of to give you a flavor of like all the things we are thinking about. So the first thing that you might try when you want to study, you know, new particles in astrophysical objects is the simplest thing, which is producing these things like in the core of the star, but, you know, producing particles that are light and weakly coupled such that they can just sort of escape and like free stream out of the star, just like neutrinos do, and see what that does. Then, you know, somewhat more difficult to calculate is like if these particles are less light and more strongly coupled and they are trapped in the star and they actually affect what goes on in the star and the equation of state of the star. So you could also imagine like what if the star captures or is seeded by, you know, dark matter or, you know, other particles, and these particles collect in the core of the star and also annihilate or do something else. Or new physics might just change the rates of known processes in the star. So these are, you know, the things that we have and are thinking about. But what we also are keeping in mind is that like nuclear astrophysics is pretty important. So as I was saying, this rate's important of like this carbon oxygen rates. And this is kind of a target generally for nuclear astrophysics. So some people have like these same people actually like in the same paper that I got the nice graph from, sort of argued that you could sort of turn this around and see the black hole mass gap as a probe of this rate. So it's kind of an interesting way of looking at it. And, you know, Jeremy's ex-team with Maria Strait and Eric Baxter is also interested in testing gravity. So testing the Newton's constant inside these stellar cores at high redshift using this process. So what we've been thinking about mostly in the last few weeks is like how to actually test this, because, you know, to show that this could be a probe of new physics, we need to A, show what the new physics does, but then also actually show that you could actually test it with data. So I'm going to also spend some time talking about how you can test this hypothesis of the black hole mass gap using the gravitational wave data set that is already available and is growing. Okay, so I will mostly sort of talk about this very first thing that new particles might do because we did that first and because I actually have, you know, some can show work on that, but we're kind of currently working on these other issues. I'll give you this as an example. Okay, so you know, the scenario here is then that light particles are produced in the star, but they're light and they're very weakly coupled, so they are produced and they immediately like kind of fly out of the star, and they just count as a sort of a weight for the star to lose energy. And so I can show you a couple of case studies. They are very similar in principle, but what's different depends on how the rates of how this new particle is produced. So as a particle physicist, if you're thinking about light particles, some natural candidates are axions and photons. So for kind of historic reasons, because we were thinking about this at the same time as the xenon one ton, you know, like excess. You know, we also looked into electrophilic axions, and then we just looked at axions that mix with that couple to standard model photons using this Stern-Simons coupling, and hidden photons which have a kinetic mixing with standard model photons. Then you know, there's other things that you might consider. So what I've seen in the literature is like scenarios of large extra dimensions, you know, typically produce like a tower of light, you know, graviton, call it Klein graviton particles, which essentially work in the same way. And models where you have a light sterile neutrino modify the neutrino magnetic moment in such a way that you don't actually produce new particles, but neutrino, like extra neutrinos get produced and therefore also introduce enhanced losses. So essentially, all of these things work in the same way, but the rates mean that the implications are somewhat different. So here's this plane again, three times. So this is the plane with core temperature versus core density. And so what I'm showing you is the rates of the production of these extra particles through the dominant process in this regime, you know, like as a function of these core temperature and core density. So what I'm showing you in particular here is that like for this first process with the electrophilic axions, you see that like as I evolve the star, like, you know, this is an example of a 55 solar mass progenitor star. If I evolve the star through helium burning, go through several decades of of this new loss channel, because this process scales pretty strongly with temperature. Whereas here on the bottom, like for the hidden photon emission, this process does not scale strongly with temperature, and therefore, like throughout helium burning, the extra loss is much more constant. And what I'm also showing you here, like in all of these different planes, is the dashed orange line, which is where this extra loss is equal to the neutrino losses. And so particularly you care about it below this line in all of these different plots. And so the way that this scales with temperature is important in what eventually ends up happening. And that's why I'm showing you that here. So, you know, this is kind of new for us. Like we didn't really know what to expect. And so what ends up happening is pretty interesting and a good guide for what might happen when you consider heavier particles as well. So what we found is that like, in this plane, like the losses are very different if you dial on this the losses are of the star are very different if you dial on this extra loss due to a new particle. And so this plane is kind of difficult to read, but let me just start talk you through it. All of these different stars are initialized here for a particular temperature and a particular mass. So this is the same, three times the same star initialized. So they all start off here. I have to like make this bigger because obviously this is like really small for compared to the rest of this plane. And what you're seeing here is, you know, you start off these stars, you evolve them. That means you move to the right here to higher temperatures. And what first hits you after the initialization phase is over in the simulation is like the wind losses. And you see that like the sort of baseline case is this gray line. And you see that like dialing up this new losses in this benchmark scenario, this is like, you know, you get a slightly smaller loss in stellar winds originally. But this is like a very small thing because I had to really like, you know, enlarge this type of area of the plots. What's really important is later on, you see the pulsations start to hit you. And the pulsation in this baseline case is here responsible for losing like almost or more than 20 solar masses. Whereas in these other two cases, actually this is like a much reduced thing. So as I was saying, like the implications of new degrees of freedom that introduce like new energetic loss mean that the wind losses of the star are a little bit lower, but the pulsation losses are much lower. And how is that possible? What does it do? So it turns out that like, you know, changing the loss rate of the star, the cooling rate of the star actually starts to burn faster through its helium. And therefore, if I plot here as a function of this new coupling of this new particle being emitted here on the x-axis, if I plot the time that it takes to reach helium depletion from the time that I start burning helium depletion in units of 10 to the 5 years, because that's about how long it takes. If I plot that, then I see that like this time that it takes to reach helium depletion goes down, like almost halves in the presence of this new particle. So the star burns like faster through its helium to compensate for this extra loss. But that then changes how much carbon and how much oxygen is produced in the two nuclear processes that I said were important. So here it is in this lower panel for the same couplings, I'm showing like the carbon to oxygen ratio at helium depletion. And so I see that like, you know, with these extra losses being on, the amount of carbon that I have produced at the end is larger, and the amount of oxygen that I've produced at the end is smaller. So what that does then is that like larger, like less oxygen and more carbon, again, pretty intuitive because oxygen is kind of like the main thing that is responsible for the pulsations. And here, like in this kind of schematic diagram, I'm showing that like dialing up the loss channels means that I have a larger C to O ratio at helium depletion. And in this schematic figure, it means that I'm moving up. And so the larger the C to O ratio is, the more likely it is that this explosive oxygen burning stage is either not at all important or less important. And so for these enhanced losses, I'm finding that greater progenitors have a greater like C to O ratio than they otherwise would have, leading to like larger black holes. Okay, and so this is kind of that in an image for this particular case, the electrophilic axion. So here, like as I was saying, like I'm assuming that the particle mass is like very small, so that I can just approximate it, like all of these particles to be produced at like with the escape velocity and introducing a loss channel. So this is like from a paper from like our first paper from last year. And I'm showing you like for these different values of the coupling, like what the final black hole mass produced is for a particular carbon oxygen mass at helium depletion, just to put all of these on the same plane. So, you know, you see here that indeed, like with this new coupling being dialed up, like the edge of the black hole mass gap shifts because I'm producing larger black hole masses with these new losses dial being on. So I should say, we were interested in this mostly because of like the Zeno-Monton axis, in which case like this particle is also produced in the sun and therefore is very light. Now that explanation of the Zeno-Monton axis, as you know, is in strong tension with other stellar cooling constraints, mostly the tip of the red giant branch. We thought this was interesting as a complementary probe. And I'll get back to like kind of the comparison between these different astrophysical probes in a minute. I just wanted to show you, like, I actually have three times the same plot, which is kind of boring maybe for you, but for different models. The difference though that I wanted to point out is that the processes producing this new particle scale differently with temperature. And that is a kind of very visible from these results. So here, if I compare this case where I have like an axion with a Stern-Simons coupling, and I compare, for example, the green line with the blue line, so this line with this line, see there's a shift. So this is like a factor 5 in the coupling, and there's a shift here. But like the same shift in the coupling, so this green line here with the red line, so this result with this result, see this, the same factor 5 in the coupling makes a very big difference here compared to what it does to the axion. And that is because of the way these processes scale with temperature. And so, as I was saying, the hidden photon case, like this scales very weakly with temperature, only linearly, whereas this photophilic axion case, it scales like temperature to the fourth power. And here, like the kind of results, the summary of the results in the previous plane show you here that like the shift in the black hole mass gap for this case is if I change a factor of 5 in the coupling, there's a shift, but it's not like very dramatic. Whereas here, the same sort of factor 5 in the coupling means a shift up, which is like a lot more extreme. So you see that in all of these cases with these extra losses, you don't change the fact that there is a mass gap. What you change though is like exactly where it is. And actually it kind of just shifts upwards in all of these cases. It's not a super precise prediction. So I can't tell you with complete definiteness that the size of the black hole mass gap isn't decreased, but it looks like the shift is like, you know, kind of, just such that the size doesn't decrease and like it just shifts upwards in masses with these extra new losses. So that's interesting. And it's kind of something we've seen like across the boards, like the prediction isn't changed. It's very hard to get out of like the fact that like you're producing lithium positron pairs and they will, initiate this kind of collapse and then trigger this explosion. That still happens, but exactly the masses for which that happens are changed. Okay, so I promised you I would sort of compare this with other astrophysical limits just to do a bit of due diligence and sort of talk about when this is important and how it compares. And so that's why I'm showing you again temperature versus density of the cores of these objects. And so as I said, like our sun, you know, sits here at about 10 to the 7 Kelvin core temperature and density that's relatively small. So I am talking about this evolution, post-main sequence evolution for like temperatures above 10 to the 8 Kelvin and upwards. And so this is what during helium burning, the tip of the red giant branch is when these things just start to be able to burn helium. So that sits like somewhere here. And so comparing like the models that I was just talking about, there exist constraints already from the sun, which we know pretty well, and from this tip of the red giant branch, which is a pretty sensitive probe in particular of these electrophilic axions. So for the models that I was showing you before, the most important constraints are these constraints on electrophilic axioms. So this you see is like a much smaller number than a number. I mean, I was really thinking about order 10 numbers. So it's like, you know, orders of magnitude different from this type of constraints. So this is actually the models that I was showing you are, you know, for these, for light mass particles are ruled out. And this constraint from the sun is important. So the real opportunity of this type of research is for to study particles that cannot be produced in these objects because the because of the temperatures here, but are produced in this post-main sequence evolution. So really kind of this type of region of the plane, where I've also kind of translated this back into statements of, that you might be used to from particle physics. So KeV, so like tens to hundreds of KeVs up into MeV particle masses. These are like what are what will be very important in this evolution and inaccessible to other astrophysical probes. But for that, we need to do a little bit more work. And that's what's going on in the at the moment. So when you start to study heavier and more strongly coupled degrees of freedom, it's not as simple as just producing these things and you can assume that they just fly out. They could remain in the star and therefore affect actually the evolution of the star and the stellar structure equations that we numerically integrate when we simulate a star. So, you know, what we want to know is like, what happens when I don't just have all the nuclear physics and all the components in that usually makes up the star. I have BSM contributions, which back reacts on the evolution. So it's a research program that we are like working on at the moment, but you can already analytically get some idea of what would happen just from the fact that like, you know what happens for electron positron pairs. So if you assume that like, particles are produced in thermal equilibrium, that's when you can start to make when you can start to make approximations, of course, like when you can do a calculation, because everything is a bit easier in equilibrium. So this is what I'm showing you here for a particular bosonic particle, you know, which either has the same mass of electrons or somewhat lighter masses. So, you know, if we produce these new particles in the star, of course, they could also just do what electron-positron pairs do and soften the equation of states. So bosons are particularly interesting in this regard because they don't have this like additional degeneracy pressure, which fermions would have. And so that's also explains the difference in this prediction. So here, this dashed line is the instability region that I calculated before, that I showed you before, which is due to electron-positron pairs. And here, the shaded regions are where I produce like a hidden photon, like a bosonic particle, which with a mass of the electron. And so you see this is like a larger region. And that's because of the spin statistics. So if I'm producing bosonic particles like that are you know, around these masses, like 100 kV to the mass of the electron, or maybe even a little bit larger, it's like it's really hard to tell what would happen in the star when it hits this new instability due to the new particle. But you know, these are regions that like you would enter for heavy stars. And that's, so that's something we're like at the moment figuring out. Because like eventually we want to probe this parameter space. And to do that, you really need to sort of look into the equation of state of the star and how it evolves. Okay, let me just check my time. Yeah, because I'm like running out of time a bit, like I am gonna kind of not really talk about this, like other probes of new physics that we've looked into and have been discussed, but you can ask me about that if you want. What I really wanna talk about is like why I think this is actually something you can figure out from the data sets, because that's the other kind of part of what I need to prove, not just that like particle physics does something in the star, but also that I can actually, you know, start to see this from the data. So, you know, this is again, like the complete data set of the first half of the third observation run. So these are like black hole masses, everything that's been publicly released so far. And so if I sort of take these masses and I draw kind of, you know, the distribution, the posterior distribution of like black hole masses from this, you know, I can already kind of start to see, you know, imagine a bit of structure that you see. So I'm going to focus on the masses. You can get further information, of course, from the spins. Yeah, but that's not something I'm going to focus on. One thing that I wanted to point out, I sort of mentioned this interesting GW 1905-21 event with a very heavy black hole masses. Turns out this one is actually still like kind of surprising. And you see here that it also kind of really quite changes this like heavy tail of this mass spectrum. So just to recap, what do we do with our stellar evolutions? What we do is like we will predict a final black hole mass from an original stellar mass, and it will look something like this. There was this like for lighter stellar masses, the black hole mass is like almost linearly like goes with the stellar mass, and then eventually there is this parent stability which kicks in and triggers this turnover, and eventually no mass is left. So this is the type of thing that we calculate using our stellar evolution simulations. Then, you know, like physics, BSM physics, particle physics, and nuclear physics may change this prediction. So it might change what the heaviest black hole mass is, and it might also change the shape of this curve. And so, you know, this is kind of a number of papers from us and from other people that have like looked at effects doing this. But then I want to know, how can we use data to test that? And that's kind of the topic of our latest paper, which will go on the archive tonight. And, you know, hopefully I'll submit after this talk. So the nice thing about this type of turnover is that there's this mass here for which this turnover kicks in. Because here, like for a whole range in stellar masses, I'm only producing like a small range in black hole masses. It means that if I actually draw the distribution curve of black hole masses, given some initial mass function, so I'm assuming an initial mass function for the stellar masses, once I draw that, there's this pileup from this region over here. So there's this kind of power law fall off first, and then there is this pileup in black hole masses right before this kind of like drop because of the mass gap. So indeed, like if I take my different scenarios and I like just fit a curve to these results we found with our stellar evolutions, and I calculate like the distribution of black hole masses that results, assuming an initial mass function, then I see indeed that there is this kind of like behavior where there is this power law fall off, and then this pileup, this peak, this one-sided peak, and then a drop off. So that's the case for you know, both this scenario and this scenario. But here I'm you know, in this scenario, pulsational parent stability was less important, and so you don't have this kind of flattening thing here. You just have this like very quick drop off here, and so you see here that the area under the curve here, the amount of black holes in the peak, is much smaller. Right. Now, you might say, okay, well, that's true, but can you not actually even astrophysically form black holes that are larger than the mass gap just because you form black holes from a stellar remnants, but then these black holes might already undergo prior mergers? And that's true, and that's also been studied. I think before a few years ago that this was thought to be very, very rare. And now people are starting to come back on that. So that's kind of an interesting situation we're in now. But I would argue that like even the black holes that are formed from prior and prior mergers inherit some information about this first mass function. And so if I kind of do the very most naive thing and I do this convolution of the black holes formed in this through stellar evolution, then you see that the secondary mass function I end up with also has a peak not that far from this parent stability peak, and then a drop off. So you might populate the mass gap, but it's not like you just sort of populate it in a random way. you also kind of expect some features right around this like peak structure. And so in the paper that we're about to submit, we model this just by like, you know, find kind of a good way to parameterize this function for different scenarios. So like in a way that can encompass like both like standard model physics and beyond the standard model physics models. And then like this pollutant population, as we call it, just with like a flat region and a power law.
I have a question here.
Yeah.
So I was thinking like, so if we go from a factor into in the uncertainty due to winds and metallicity, how then this yellow line, the one which is like a strong cutoff, can get tapered and mix up with this distribution of astrophysical sources? Like how, I may not have this sharp feature at all if I have an uncertainty because of wind and metallicity.
I may not have that. What? Sorry, this.
So the sharp cutoff which you're showing in this figure around 45, around 45.
Okay, I see what you're saying. I think I see what you're saying. So you're saying like, okay, what if like metallicity differences? Because you
and wind
and different stellar winds across the population, right? So yes. Yeah. So what I would argue is that it would introduce some scatter. And that would like kind of make this feature like less pronounced. And like, you find that like with different metallicity and stellar wind prescriptions, this shifts, but it doesn't shift by like, you know, factor like by like 10 solar masses. It shifts by like, you know, one or two solar masses. And so, yeah, I would say that introduces some scatter and it introduces, you know, a bit of like, a bit of kind of uncertainty, a bit of softening of this peak, but you would still have this kind of like, you know, kind of peak like feature and a drop off, I would argue, even if you have some, you know, across the sort of population of stellar remnants, you know, some scatter in like the winds that was of effect and the metallicity that was effect.
Maybe what I'm trying to understand is how the difference in the two peaks, what decides this value? Like one is around 10 to minus 2, other is around 10 to minus 4. So how robust is this difference?
Oh, so this is not something that is known. In fact, so for what I'm going to show you in a minute, we just float the this kind of ratio between these different populations, but it's not at all known like at the moment, you know, what the merger rate is in a particular environment and like how this like would look and like especially how these two would scale. So I would say this is a very new thing, and there's definitely people that like work on this type of like secondary like population a lot more than I do. So we just did a very naive thing, just allowing for a population that pollutes, if you will, the mass gap. You know, that population not being completely featureless. So the way we modeled it is just allowing for a power law with a random with a normalization we float and a power index we float.
I see. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. So can I ask another question related to this? So what about subsequent accretion to these black holes? Because I mean, you form them, but then they are sitting in some environment or they might be in a binary, so they could grow over time.
Yeah, good question also. So I should say, like, maybe I should sort of like do a bit more advertising. We were actually the first ones to study like the black hole mass catalog, like from the last sort of like gravitational wave catalog with this type of like kind of this type of like model fitting their instability. So all of this is very new, and black hole accretion, stellar winds, metallicity, all of these things might change this like prediction somewhat. So here we just assume one. So accretion has been studied not by us, but by other people. I think it's rare to expect that accretion be so important that it actually significantly shifts this. I know the LIGO and Virgo collaboration have mentioned it, like, and kind of talked about it in some of their papers from last year. I think a good reference to look at is the announcement paper of GW 1905-21, which includes like all the kind of main references. I think accretion is not supposed to be as important as some of the other things that might change, like, you know, this type of prediction, just because you need like a whole lot of accretion to actually change this by a lot.
Okay, thank you.
Right. So, oops. Okay, so I think I'm like running out of time. So let me just sort of show you what we got with this. So again, like the first time like study like that, this kind of this data set has been studied with a mass function that is really inspired by stellar evolution results and allows for like this pair instability peak to be where it should be in the standard model. So the model, like the most successful model that like the LIGO Virgo collaboration used on this data set, is what they call power law plus peak model, that's here in blue. But here, this their peak was not allowed to go beyond 50, and so actually fits here in this like you know, in this area where you wouldn't actually predict, you know, pair instability to be important. So I'm showing you our like results and the LIGO results. Now you see here that like with the inclusion of this like this high mass event, what our result prefers is like this kind of peak and break in the spectrum. So this thing here to be at like pretty high masses. But if I actually remove this event in the data set, something that's much more compatible with the standard model prediction is found. And so you see here this peak and this break is actually around like 50 solar masses, which is what you would expect in the standard model. That's still like kind of an interesting event. And I, you know, just want to sort of spend like a few words like on this type of this event and why I think like this is sort of still kind of very interesting. So, you know, as I was saying, this is a very like puzzling event because it has like black holes of like 80 solar masses and 60 solar masses, very, very, very heavy black holes, which really should not exist. Of course, they can exist, right? Like even in this type of model that we're using, it's not impossible that these exist. It's just very unlikely that you would have picked them up in this first data set. If I compare sort of the model that we're proposing and this most successful model in a LIGO Virgo data sets, so we are actually allowing for only one dimensional parameter, and that's this like black hole mass gap parameter. And so like including or not including this event, I'm shifting from the dashed line to the continuous line. So that's true for our model. And then like the LIGO Virgo collaboration uses two dimensional parameters. And then you see that the largest dimensional parameter in their model also shifts with the inclusion or non-inclusion of this GW 1905-21 event. And so you can see that like including or not including this one event, at least a one-dimensional parameter in the model shifts, the preference for one-dimensional parameter shifts. And so it's in our model, there's just one-dimensional parameter and that one shifts. And so the conclusion that you would draw is very different. I'm showing you here the standard model prediction. So the like without this event is compatible with that, and with the event, this event is not. And so I think this is really at the moment still like a puzzling thing, and larger data sets will actually be able to tell us more about like what this event actually was. So it could be just a very rare like higher generation black hole merger events, but it could be, as other people have pronounced in the literature, a straddling binary. So if you like, there's been a paper by Maya Fishbeck and then Holtz studying this again, like reevaluating GW190521 with different prior choice, and they found actually like a different kind of mass, different masses, one of which was like compatible with being below the mass cap and one being very large. Or it could be the first hint of new physics. And I think for this type of events, like only time will tell. So future data sets will point out whether this was actually a very rare thing that we were just lucky to have in our first catalog, or just a very rare event that you know, is part of like a higher generation black holes. And still one like Indiana Jones reference. Nothing shocks me, I'm a scientist. Okay, I ran out of time now. So I want to conclude. I think gravitational waves are a very exciting new opportunity to study questions in astrophysics and particle physics. So they allow you to look at things that are otherwise hard to detect. So black holes are a good example. You know, through EM radiation, we can look at black holes when they're in binaries or when they're accreting gravitational waves. From binary mergers allow you to look at black holes just through their gravitational interactions. So I think pairing stability supernovae are intriguing. They lead to this whole kind of region of unpopulated space in the stellar graveyards. And the black hole mass gap is just an entirely new thing to observe. And it could be a probe of particle and nuclear physics, because like small disturbances in the stellar cores lead to actually this macroscopic shift in the black hole mass gap prediction. So at the moment, we're really kind of at the start of like actually being able to study black hole populations in detail. And I argue that you could use those to sort of to go back and study stellar evolution. And that's something I would call black hole archaeology. So thank you very much. And yeah, I'm happy to answer a few more questions if you have them.
Okay, great. Thanks, Juna. So let's all unmute to give her a round of applause. Okay, awesome. So we are a couple of minutes over, but not too bad. So are there any further questions for Juna?
I had one question. If it's about the picture you were showing on one of the slides about the mass gap, I think in different axion models or different, and you showed like that the mass gap can change kind of, you know, the slope and it's, exactly. I was wondering, is this constraint, I mean, how constrainable would you think this is? Like, do you think that, astrophysics-wise, these changes are significant, and you know, what kind of samples would we need to kind of make to rule out or rule in some of these models?
Yeah, good question. I think that's a hard question to answer. Like, I think because really, you should imagine that. Like, I mean, last year I learned about this the mass gap existing at all, like about last year, and it hadn't been studied like, you know, in like new physics in these stars, like in the prediction of new physics, shifting this mass gap hadn't been calculated at all. And also we're currently living with a 50 event data set, and that's, you know, already, that's impressive, but like statistically, you know, still like not large enough to actually, you know, kind of even point out the edge of the mass gap and make predictions. So I think I think it would be a bit too speculative of me to actually kind of, you know, give you some numbers. But I think we will, in the next few years, with the growing data set and also the next few observation runs of the LIGO and Virgo collaboration, I think we will be able to detect a peak-like structure and this break in the mass function. If it is there, a few solar masses in precision, and that will tell you whether something extreme would have gone on in the stars. So, you know, eventually the hope is to do even better than that. And so maybe I'm like very optimistic, but like, you know, these things also actually change the shape of this mass function by quite a bit. So if you could actually have like a lot of data and like see how many black holes are here kind of in this pulsation variability peak, that would of course be, you know, extra, like would be fantastic. But I think the data set would have to grow by at least an order of magnitudes to be able to say a bit more about that, which, you know, could happen with 04 and 05.
Yeah, it's also because the astrophysics, some of the discussions here, like of the explosion might not, or the merger here would not maybe, you know, be completely constrained with the, so you might need, yeah, but this is very interesting.
Absolutely. And like, I think, I mean, also these mass, these have error bars, right?
Exactly. So these masses,
yeah, which is folded into the analysis, of course. But yeah, so if you have a, you know, you also need to be somewhat lucky, I guess, like if you have like a high mass ratio event, you typically do a bit better with the error bars. So yeah, it's very hard to actually predict. But I, you know, I think the good thing is that this is a data set that is only going to keep growing in the next few years. So yeah, the statistics will definitely get better.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, Chris, you have your hand raised?
Yeah, well, first of all, that was an excellent and very inspiring discussion of what's possibly behind all of this. There was a little bit of discussion in the chat while you were talking about which aspects of stellar astrophysics you can trust within one-dimensional codes like MESA. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously reaction rates and wind prescriptions and things like that. You can vary the prescriptions within the code and test things out, overshooting parameters and things like that. Mm-hmm. But, and rotation, which I guess is dealt with at some level of validity within the codes. One thing that worries me a little bit is that this process of removing matter from the progenitor for the collapsing black hole involves, you know, involves hydrodynamics of a type that isn't usually at work within stars. So it involves pulsational mass loss and pulsations and, you know, the formation of shocks and the ejection of material. That's not what these codes were built for. They're not intrinsically good hydrodynamics codes. And mm-hmm. So I've been a little bit worried that perhaps MESA doesn't do that right. And that might be true of the other stellar evolution codes as well that also deal with this. Do you have any sense for if there were a systematic error in the just the overall dynamics of where that energy winds up within the star and how strong an outflow comes from a particular pulsation, whether that makes a difference in the final result? Or is that all sort of secondary because this is a self-regulating mechanism that basically has to bring the star below the core instability criterion no matter what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. So yeah, that's, I mean, it's kind of hard to get like a kind of a sense for that since like, you know, as far as I know, like barren stability and like these pulsations have only been studied, I think, in one-dimensional codes. So
even in 1D, there are bad hydro codes. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. So even if you restrict yourself to 1D, they're not good hydrodynamics codes. It's not like running a, you know, highly resolved, high order hydro code on the same problem. Mm-hmm. So I think there are systematic differences in the dynamics and the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
That's mm-hmm. not really a very well posed question. I'm just wondering if you think it makes a difference that there is this underlying issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think that could make a difference. Like, yeah. So So I think maybe the best like way to get a feel for it is, I think, just actually varying the hydrodynamics prescription within the 1D code and see how much of a difference that makes. But yeah, I mean, that's only kind of give you a bit of an idea, I guess.
I don't know if it helps, but I have done some analytical work on this type of hydrodynamics. Mm-hmm. So it's possible to know what the answer ought to be for mm-hmm. certain well-posed mm-hmm. problems. So mm-hmm. that's yeah. how I know Lib Mesa isn't very good.
Okay, yeah. So have you studied like this, like variant stability supernovae, like analytics?
Not specifically, but mm-hmm. I've studied the outcome of pulsations and, you know, mass eruption from the surface.
Okay, that seems relevant.
The same yeah. general topics.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, no, that seems relevant. I mean, so that's not a part that I have like really looked into in detail. So I know that Mesa has like undergoes all these like evolution, right? So the latest version of Mesa has specifically, you know, kind of worked on the variance stability, you know, parts. And so it'd be interesting to compare with your analytic work, you know, to see like, you know, what could be problematic and how that would change the outcome. So yeah, definitely. I will have a look at your papers on that. Yeah, sounds interesting.
Okay, so I see that Mina raised her hand. So she asked the final question because we're all.
I have one final question to ask. If mm-hmm. you, because I may have missed it, if you flashed it, how, let's assume you have control of all astrophysical uncertainties and mm-hmm. what reach do you have relative to other experiments or astrophysical constraints?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think the most like promising reach, I think, is because these are like very, very hot objects that are still not like, I mean, of course, proton neutron stars are hotter, but they're also a lot denser. So like, I think about it in terms of this plane. So where like my evolution lies here for these like, you know, 10 to the 9 Kelvin, say, which corresponds to about like 100 to 1,000, or so 100 kV to an MeV, and still these kind of densities of like, you know, just before electron degeneracy. So I think the compared to other astrophysical probes, people typically use the sun, which you understand very well, the tip of the red giant branch, which sits here just when you start to burn helium. This is like a hotter temperature, and compared to neutron stars, this is far less dense.
But have you put everything together? Because there's already up to a few MeV, in fact, the couplings of these particles are quite constrained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess that's right.
This is what I want to see. I understand what you're saying here, but I want to see uh-huh. a plot.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, so that plot I don't have yet, because like this is not like this is something we're working on at the moment, like simulating these like heavier particles. But so for particular models, like I guess this is a model dependent question. Yeah. But like, for example, maybe actually I do have like a plot like for in the appendix. Let me see. So you would use astrophysics to plot smaller couplings that you do on Earth. And so we are interested in the parameter space here for like small couplings and temperatures and masses like larger than you can produce in the red giant, in the tip of the red giant branch. So here, this parameter space. But don't have like an exclusion region or something yet. Like that's just still a work in progress.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so in view of the time, let's stop here. So thanks again, Juna. I feel your fascinating talk. And thanks to everyone else for coming. Okay, so we'll stop here. Everyone.
All right.